Today is Thursday. It's May 13th, 2021. It's 1:38 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. Here we go again with another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
John Hansen from Block Club Chicago and on WGN Radio.
And I'm Eric Zorn, also not guilty, columnist from the Tribune.
What? What?
Alderman Patrick Daly Thompson on Thursday afternoon pleaded not guilty to his to the bank charges against him, the tax charges, and I just wanted to underscore that I'm also not guilty of those things.
Yeah, that's how low the bar is. We'll get to that in a little bit. Let's start here, though. Illinois inched closer to Phase 5 this week. Today, in fact, we are going to the bridge phase. Help me if I'm wrong on this, guys. And hopefully to a full reopening June 11th. The CDC is lifting the mask requirements for indoors, but with a couple of exceptions. Airplanes, you'll still have to wear a mask. Healthcare facilities and businesses where they're required. But by and large, indoors, we are about to, the CDC says, not have to wear face masks. The state is waiting for the CDC to say that, so possibly this week or next. I'm not sure when that will go down. That means we will have to find other ways to instantly judge and dislike people. Capacity will go to 60% at Sox and Cubs games, too, by the way. Heather, do you know when are we going to not have to wear masks indoors? When is that going to go down?
I don't know. That. So the CDC, literally, as we are taping this, just made it official, breaking news in the future for our listeners. And it's not clear when IDPH, the state, and the city will follow that recommendation, but they've been aligned all along. So I would expect that to happen relatively quickly.
Right. And you could still wear yours indoors if you want. I'm not sure if your employer could continue to mandate it. Maybe they could. But how many of us are anxious to rip the damn thing off, burn it, and exercise the new freedom we have? I'll go first. Me. Hansen, you ready to tear yours off and go without it?
I'm fine, too. I'm excited, too. I haven't found it to be as much of an inconvenience as other people have. And I started at a CrossFit gym this past year and still wear it every day. That's the one place I can't wait to take it off. But grocery stores, I'll still probably wear it on the train, CTA, stuff like that. I'm still going to be wearing it on.
I was thinking, so I was in, I missed the podcast, I think, 2 weeks ago because I was in Miami. And we were at, I was at a pool in Miami that had a topless policy at the pool. And there was one woman who, very large woman from Nebraska, had a Kate Gosselin haircut, and she would take her position at the head of the pool with no top every morning at like 7 a.m. and just be the queen of the pool the whole day. And that is how I will feel probably when I'm allowed to be back at work, showing my face to everybody.
A lot to unpack there, Austin.
Wow.
So when you say topless, you don't mean the top of a face mask. You mean a bikini top.
Yeah, that's right.
Where the hell were you?
I told you, I was in Miami.
Oh, I know that.
Did you choose that pool on purpose?
Well, yeah, what a coincidence.
We had no idea.
Really?
No idea. But, and it was really, it wasn't common. I mean, she was definitely in the minority, but she was just having a great time, and I really appreciated her vibe and energy.
Did she have a Cornhusker tattoo or something? How did you know that she was from Nebraska?
I asked her because I was fast. I would see her every day, and I'm like, what? This woman is so confident and cool.
She
and
is
she
that
clearly,
I guess,
you know, like, you know, has this thing, and yeah, she's from Nebraska.
See, if you were sitting in a pool topless, and God bless you, it's okay, you get to do that, I would not approach you to have a conversation about the Cornhuskers or face masks.
It was later. It was actually later. I
she had her clothes on at that time.
She had her clothes on at that point. It would have been a very like Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David thing.
Evidently she's not against conversation. She's not even against clothes. So that's your hang up, not hers. We digress. Heather?
I'm like John. Really, because I've been lucky enough to work at home, the only place where I've had to consistently wear a face mask is when I've been at the gym. And I guess I will be glad to not have to wear it while I'm on the elliptical machine. I'm a little bit more worried than it sounds like you are. I was talking about this a little bit before we went on the air, but both of my kids are younger than 12, which means they're not eligible for the vaccine. And it's not a zero, you know, it's not 100% protection that I won't get the virus, but suffer no symptoms and then pass it on to them. And that you know, is my biggest concern right now.
Yeah.
I know that that is relatively a low risk, and I'm grateful to be fully vaccinated, and I'm grateful my husband is fully vaccinated, and I'm grateful my mom is fully vaccinated, but it's not zero risk.
I don't have kids. I mean, I was clearly speaking for myself. And by the way, if you wear a mask around me at the grocery store or whatever, God bless you. You're doing me a favor. You're doing the world a favor. You are a better soldier than I am. So I will not judge you for that. That's for sure.
I'm not really ready for this sort of indoor close encounters with strangers not wearing masks yet. It gives me much more comfort still to, if I'm going into a gas station or if I'm going, you know, just any sort of grocery store, pharmacy, any place like that, I like the feeling of being masked and having other people masked. And I think that's just, it's really in some ways psychological, because I realize that as someone who has been vaccinated, that mm-hmm. I'm not at really particular risk of either of shedding the virus or of getting the virus. But I'm still, and part of it is, of course, symbolic, too, that there's, that you want to send the message out to people not to be casual about this and to realize that it is still out there. It's ravaging India. There's still, 30% of the population that's, or 40% that's not vaccinated. And we're not out of the woods yet. And wearing a mask is a symbol of that to people. And so it maybe reminds people who aren't vaccinated, like, oh, yeah, this is still.
Well, are you going to judge me then when I skip by without a mask on?
Yes, I will judge you.
I mean,
more
I think
for
that's,
the skipping.
No, but I think that's interesting what you say, Eric, because I think that we have all collectively judged as fools or selfish the people that don't wear masks. And now we have this get out of jail card. You need to now throw that switch the other way and say John is doing what the governor said to do. Get out and don't wear a mask if you don't want to.
Well, it's an interesting metaphor, the switch, because I think that, yeah, you're right about that, because the switch was flipped the other way, and we got into the habit of wearing masks just about all the time, and it began to feel very weird, you know, even last fall, last summer, to be anywhere around people and not wearing masks. And then you've got, I mean, you can't, I don't think you can just flip the switch back. I think you had to jam that switch over, and then to pull it back is going to be difficult.
Yeah.
And of course, the other thing is that, you know, having gone now more than a year without getting a cold, I'm thinking maybe, like when I ride the L or when, and I'm in close, when I'm riding in elevators with people, maybe a mask isn't such a terrible idea.
I think I'll carry one, you know, and then when I am in a high-risk situation, at least by the old metric, I might slip it on, knowing it's just making me feel more comfortable than maybe it is actually protecting me. The risk presumably is lower.
One wrinkle here that might be a glimmer of hope, but I'm not sure yet, is UCLA did a lot of good survey work on vaccine hesitancy and incentives to get vaccines. And among Democrats, a very good incentive seemed to just be cash payments. But among Republicans, the biggest mover was that you no longer had to wear a mask when you were vaccinated.
Hmm.
So in theory, this is really good news for vaccine uptake, is that, hey, you don't have to wear a mask if you get a vaccine. Of course, the problem is, you know, if socially you can just not wear a mask and it's not questioned in any way, then there's no cost. Like why you could just lie and say
right.
You had the vaccine. So who knows?
John, what do you think about the Ohio plan to incentivize people? They're doing a vaccine lottery. You get $1 million if you're vaxxed and your name is drawn. But the people that are in the pool are the people that have been vaxxed. What do you make of that?
Well, I was so excited when you were talking about this morning on your show that I texted you, because I disagree with your take entirely. And I was excited to tell you here on the podcast. I love the idea, not only for the incentive to do it, which might move a few people, but what I think that people are missing that are against this is the PR that this has created is invaluable to, I mean, imagine how much money the state of Ohio has to spend to get on media markets in certain areas to encourage people to get their vaccine. That costs millions of dollars anyways. This free media blitz that they get from this alone, and as it spreads across the country, just the more people you talk about getting vaccines, it's just the reason to get a vaccine. It's safe, whatever the case may be, drummed up more than the paid media I could have and saved the state in the long run. I think it's a genius idea.
You think that the reason people haven't been getting vaccinated is because they haven't heard the positive information about a vaccine?
It also makes me think, though, that if you are letting the information get out there that you need to pay people to get the vaccine. The government wants mm-hmm. you to get the vaccine. They're going to pay you. Maybe makes people more hesitant because they're thinking like, well, this must not be good because they're having to bribe people to do it.
Yeah, that's thank you for carrying my water here, Eric. I mean, that was one of the points I was making on the radio. Look, in any lottery, only one person wins and millions of people lose. How is this not the state kind of hoodwinking people into getting a thing that they don't want to put into their bodies? An ill-informed, mind you, but it's their decision. They've decided they don't want to get a vaccine. And the state says, I know, let's trick these gullible people into getting the vaccine. Why are you rolling your eyes, Hansen?
Because it's not a trick. People that play the normal lottery also know that they probably won't win. So I don't think that that's the barrier there. And I think the way that the governor, Mike DeWine, has framed it is clever. It's creative. It's, hey, this is an incentive. This is what you do. We know it's great. We know it works. This isn't some trick in the back alley where a doctor's going to jab you if you walk on by. This is, hey, join this. This is a collective fun experience.
Yeah, I do think it's better than the idea that I think we kicked around the idea of paying people $100
yeah.
to get vaccinated. That was, I think, Darlene Glanton's column where she was saying that we mm-hmm. should pay people $100. And then there was the question of, well, what about me? I got my vaccine already. Do I get paid? And I thought that wasn't a great argument. But somebody wrote to you, John, or was it to me? And I shared it with you, but it was saying like, what that may do is when we next have a pandemic, which we probably will, people are going to hold out. They're going to say, well, I'm not going to get my shot yet.
What have you got?
They haven't dangled the cash in front of me yet. I'm going to wait. So that seems like a really good reason not to pay people $100 to get a shot. So
I thought the funniest point was yours last week, Eric. I believe it was you who said, so let me see if I got this straight. You think that the vaccine is bad for you, but I'll give you $100 and now you're okay. I mean, come on, would you do something bad for you for $100? That's what we're saying. And John, I think that's the ethic that the state is laying on people with the lottery too. It's like, we know you think this is bad, but hey, you could win. At least in Illinois, you'd get $100. In Ohio, you're going to get jack squat.
Just embrace the fun of it. That chance at a million, come on.
We're going to find out pretty easily. So like every economist in America is drooling because it's this amazing natural experiment. You can take every border county in Michigan, every border county in Ohio, for example, and see what the uptake is. One thing that we'll want to look for, I think, is does it just accelerate vaccination among people who would have already had it? Who would have already gotten it, but have been mm-hmm. putting it off for whatever reason, or does it actually raise the bar above expectation?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I noted that 34% of the unvaccinated among us still say they won't get a vaccine. I don't know if this is going to move those numbers, Austin, but even as 12 to 15 year olds become eligible. And Heather, you'll absolutely get your children vaccinated when they're of age, right?
Absolutely. The second we can, we will. And the data from the CDC is really incredible. In the trials of kids 12 to 15, not a single person who got the vaccine got COVID, which is 100% protective. And the side effects that the people in the trials reported were no different than any of the adult side effects, like a sore arm, maybe a little bit of fever, some chills. The real question, I think, about that is, when will pediatricians get the vaccine? Because right now there's still not quite enough supply for every pediatrician to have it. And I think that's a real issue, because parents who might be a little bit more hesitant than me will want to hear it directly from their pediatrician that it's safe.
Well, what do you think the reason is that people aren't getting it now?
Two things. I think one, I think there have been a lot of people who were just unwilling to play the vaccine Hunger Games, that they were not willing to sit on a computer and hit mm-hmm. refresh until they got a vaccine. They were also not willing to go to a mass vaccination site where they were concerned, A, about being exposed to COVID, and B, having to stand in a long line or something like
sure.
that.
One really underreported reason that I've seen for lack of for vaccine hesitancy is something that it's hard to get in survey results, but researchers have done it for a while on the flu, is literally fear of needles.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't thought about. It's huge. So I think even among hospital workers, there was a great study on influenza vaccination and hesitancy there. And it was like 25% of hospital employees were afraid of needles. And that's why they didn't want to get a flu vaccine. So I think it also speaks to invest. Like if the country is going to continue to spend trillions of dollars on spending in the wake of COVID, investing in like oral vaccinations are a thing and a big field of research, and would be could pay off big if you were able to get one.
Haven't heard people talk about the politics of it anymore. Maybe it's because Trump's been largely silenced, or maybe that statement has been made. I don't know. Do you guys think that's still, you know, I'm not going to do what you people say to do? To be honest with you, I don't even now recall exactly how Donald Trump kept people from getting the vaccine. But you'd think that since he's no longer president, that his influence would not be a factor anymore, right? And I don't think people really think that Bill Gates is putting chips in the serum, and so it's not that. But still, it's still large numbers of people, the percentages of Americans, say they won't get the vaccine. I'm trying to figure out, what you said, Heather, notwithstanding, what some of those reasons are. And I would have said that the politics of it was a big one while Donald Trump was president.
Yeah, I think actually, interestingly, a lot of Democrats were against having the vaccine when it was Trump was the president, and that switched when Biden became the president. Of course, it's the same vaccine. Didn't matter. That shouldn't have made any difference. The one really strange thing that still bugs me is that President Trump and Melania got the vaccine in January while they were in the White House and didn't tell anyone. And that was the strangest thing about it all. I think a lot of people want to give President Trump credit for getting the vaccine out quickly, and we can debate that another time, or never if we want to. But I never understood why he didn't trumpet it more. He's done that since. But I think for the most part, if it's a political thing, everyone's in their camps where they are now. They've made those decisions. Those are the unswayables. But I think the vast majority of people live somewhere in the middle of that.
I still know people, though, that aren't getting it and won't get it because they think the vaccine is going to be worse than the disease, or at least they think it's more likely they'll get sick from the vaccine, and they don't think they'll get sick from COVID-19.
What I've heard most is that people are unsure about what the long-term effects of this vaccine is going to be. That I think you would have to be really foolish or crazy to think that the vaccine is going to kill you instantly or make you sick instantly. We've had, you know, how many tens or hundreds of millions of people around the world vaccinated, and there just haven't been these sort of immediate side effects. There was that blip where there was some blood clots, but basically, you know, the safety, the short-term safety of this vaccine has been established to a very high degree. It's much safer than a lot of treatments and things that we do. So, but the concern about this new technology and what it's going to be, what it's going to do in 5 years, 10 years, there's questions about fertility that people have. And I think most of those have been studied and most of them have good answers, but they don't have the same sort of obvious answer that the idea that you're going to get the shot and get COVID. People, I think, are under the misimpression that this is one of those vaccines where they give you a dead form of the virus.
Yeah.
And it's not that. It's a different technology totally. It's not homeopathic in that way. It's totally a different way of attacking the disease. Yet, you know, I can understand that. I can respect that fear. I also say that, well, life has risks in it, and there's the studies show that it's worth it, and it's worth it for the public to do this. So, but I think that's, if you really were to poke down in this, there's probably a small group of people who think it's a hoax, that the whole thing's a hoax. There's a small group of people who think that Bill Gates is installing microchips in you so he can track you to the store and back. But most people, I think, have some concerns about injecting a chemical into their body and not being exactly sure what it does.
Mm-hmm,
and you know, those of us who've said that, I guess mockery doesn't work. I wish it did, because that's kind of a thing that columnists like to do.
Well, it cements their position, don't you think, Eric?
It cements whose position?
The mockies.
Yeah, if you can't, if you turn it into something where you're trying to shame somebody, and so they dig deeper back into their position rather than say, well, let's have a conversation.
Well, absolutely. If you mock
them, points out that the best people to make these approaches are trusted figures, doctors being the best ones, but it's like, I am not going to get up and convince somebody who lives in a small town in central Illinois, and I'm not going to wag my finger at them until they get the vaccine, but their physician, their clergyman, their neighbors, those are the people who are going to say, hey, you know what? This is probably the best thing to do, and it's going to get us all out of this sooner. Those are the kinds of people. That's the kind of influence that's going to get the job done.
Want to move on to the Liz Cheney story, ousted in the number three position for the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. Adam Kinzinger, I was just about to say, did not vote with the majority, but it was a secret poll. It was a
voice vote.
It was a yay or nay voice vote.
Just voice vote.
And then I noticed the Belleville Democrat asked some of the downstate lawmakers how they voiced, and one of three of the three they asked, Congressman Miller, said she was with the yays, but the other two said, I just think it's time we move forward on this thing.
Didn't LaHood and was it Bost? Is that the other one? Didn't both of them say that they were not there, that they were late or something like that?
Davis really? And LaHood said that they didn't make it.
I think this is so cowardly. I mean, it should be a recorded vote. I mean, fine. You don't want Liz Cheney to be the number three Republican. What do I care? But if the reason is because you all are still adhering to the big lie, I think you should go on the record with that. LaHood was late. Oh, that's hilarious.
I don't know. It's internal politics. They can make it a secret vote if they want, or a voice vote. These aren't recorded legislative votes that are taken. I agree. I want to know how each person voted. But of course, that was all by design. Of course, they did a voice vote so people could say that they, you know, let's move past this. That's the whole reason to do it. And that's the tightrope that Kevin McCarthy has been walking with this whole thing, to say that we don't want Liz Cheney anymore, but then to speak outside of the White House yesterday and say, no one's challenging the election results anymore. I just talked to the president. I mean, it'll be fascinating to see if he's able to pull this off and become speaker in 2022. It'll be an amazing tightrope walk that he did to be able to get that done.
Well, let me say this also about the secret ballot that the Republicans had. I think that Liz Cheney has the last, 3 months or so that she has been in that position, to the secret ballot to thank for that. Because if the Republicans and all had to go on the record back a few months ago when they voted to keep her, she probably wouldn't have made it, because it was such a dangerous vote for them to take. And even up till the vote, there was still people thinking, well, maybe they're not going to do this. They're going to when they get a secret ballot, the Republicans are going to realize this is really insane. Because what it's going to do, what this vote has done, is every campaign in 2022, the first question you're going to ask any Republican candidate is, where do you stand on the big lie? Did you vote, or would you have voted to keep Liz Cheney? And they're going to be gibbering with fear because they can't answer that question. They can't say, that was a mistake, that was a wrong thing for the party to do, all she did was tell the truth, and not incur the wrath of dear leader Donald Trump. So, yes, we did the right thing and she should have gone, then moderate voters are going to run for the hills.
Are they saying that the reason that they bounced her was because of what she said about the election, or because, in fact, she was not in lockstep with the party on a number of other issues? Jim Jordan was on with Laura Ingraham on Fox News the night before the election, before the vote, and he said it wasn't just that, and then he had all of his talking points about that.
You can't have the Republican conference chair reciting Democrat talking points, especially when gas prices are up 50%, there's a crisis on the border, and Democrats are trying to federalize election law and pack the United States Supreme Court. That is not helpful. That is the concern, and that's why 3 months ago, there were a number of us who wanted to make a change. That change, in fact, will happen, and I think that's a good thing for our party. You want our party spokesperson to be in tune with more than a single-digit percentage of the party. 90-some percent of the party disagree with Congresswoman Cheney. There needs to be a change. And again, I think that's going to happen, and I think it'll be a strong vote.
So what is it? Is it that she's not really a leader of the party, or is it that she just didn't endorse the big lie? Which is it?
What positions has she taken in the last couple of months that were different from positions she'd taken before, or different from the position she'd taken to get her into the number three spot in the House? I don't watch Laura Ingraham.
Oh, you should. She's on TV. She's really good.
I'm sure she is. I'll make a note to do that. But I can't imagine that anything, the only thing that's changed, let's be honest, the only thing that's changed, the reason this has got them all excited, is because she is openly challenging President Trump's claims about the election. And she's not shutting up about it, and they don't like that. And they, for some reason, idiotic consensus in their party is that this is a good way to make this whole issue go away and unify the party.
I think
that is politically crazy.
Well, one thing that Jordan said on Laura Ingraham's show, she's on Fox News, you should watch it, she's got a really good show, is that whatever the other items are, if one of them is that 90%+ of the Republicans in that body feel this way and she feels differently, then de facto she's not a leader of that group anymore. If that's how they feel about it, then if you're the then we'll get somebody else to endorse what we are doing here. That almost makes it sound more legitimate, what I'm opining here on behalf of Representative Jordan.
The steel man versus, you know, as compared to straw man argument, the best one I've heard for her getting out is exactly your point, John, which is basically that the role of Republican leadership or party leadership generally is to just make life easier for everybody else. Like maybe some of us know what the number three Republican does, what the conference chair does. I don't think anyone else does. I personally do not.
Right.
But that's not the reason. The reason wasn't just that she's making their lives hard. It was the fealty to Trump and the cult of personality there that was the issue. And that's why she's out. And I think it's too early to tell what the effects of that will be. So 2022, I think the Republicans will have to severely screw up to not take, what is it, 5 seats to mm-hmm. take back the House. So if Trump starts getting involved in primaries and starts racking up lots of wins in close races, that'll change things. If he doesn't, then I think this is completely forgotten.
Her congressional district is the entire state of Wyoming, right? So right. I wonder how this will play. Does this cancel her?
It all depends on, of course, there are going to be a number of challengers, and Trump will probably back one of them. He was saying yesterday, Trump tweeted, I didn't tweet it, but he issued a statement calling Cheney a horrible person.
Yeah.
And politically, I don't know if you want your party there. And I think the smart thing for them to have done would have been to just kind of say, well, we're a big tent and Liz Cheney has her opinion about the election and other people have their opinion. And that's not anything we're going to be voting on. It's not a policy item. We're trying to win the elections in 2022 and we have a variety of candidates and we're focused on that. We're not focused on the election of 2020. And this just ripped the scab off that wound. And, you know, Austin may be right that by next spring when the primary voters go to the polls and certainly by November of 2022 when general election voters, this may all be totally forgotten. But I don't see it incrementally as a smart move. I don't see how it redounds to their advantage.
Isn't it going to be great political theater in 2022? Like, where are they going to deploy Trump for primaries? Which primary candidates do they want running in generals? And then what happens in 2022 general or in the off-year election? I mean, where the only swing districts basically are suburban districts where Trump did terribly this last election. It did terribly in 2018. So how much they deploy him, what that is like, you'll be, oh boy, that'll be fun to watch.
Well, at least
I enjoy political theater as much as John Hansen does, I know. But I want to take a moment and remind us all that we are not talking about a difference of policy or a difference of like tax rates or something like that. We are talking about the fundamental right for Americans to vote and have that vote counted in a free and fair manner. What's at issue here is whether the 2020 election was held correctly or whether there was a massive fraud and that Joe Biden is an illegitimate president. Now, I want to be clear. If you are a Republican, the party's position is that you can do one of two things. You can say that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, or you cannot say anything at all. And I think that I fear for our democracy, because that is just not a tenable position for one political party in a two-party system to take, because the Republicans have endorsed explicitly a position that there was massive voter fraud in the 2020 election and that we are essentially being governed by an illegitimate government. I think it's real easy to sort of fall into this trap of figuring out, like, how is this going to play out in the horse race? Who's up, who's down? But we have one political party saying that the 2020 election was illegitimate. And there is an ongoing audit in Arizona designed to overturn those results.
Well, you're right. It's not just Liz Cheney's future, but it's really the direction the Republican Party is going. And the Republican Party is not going to be taken over by the party of Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. it's going to it is what it is, and it maintains a great deal of power because of the way political maps are drawn. So we do have to worry about this quite a bit, because it's pretty clear that they are buying into the cult of Donald Trump, and that is a dangerous cult.
You know, I wonder if it's just either or. Then you say, okay, well, I can't go with Cheney, but maybe it's not a full throttled endorsement of Trump's position. It's just, I got to pick a side, and I don't like this side that much, but I'm 51% over on the Trump side. I'm not 100%, but I can't be on the 49% side with Kinzinger and Cheney. And
when did democracy become a 51-49 issue? Honestly, I'm asking.
I don't know, but I'm just gauging. All I'm trying to do is assess what Eric is talking about, the future of the Republican Party, or what you're saying, the future of democracy. Maybe these guys aren't as anti-democracy as it sounds. All they're saying is, we don't like Liz Cheney. That's more about we don't like Liz Cheney than we believe the big lie. But there's no room for a middle vote on that.
I was going to say, I honestly don't think that's relevant, because unless you can, when you are, as Jim Jordan, you know, went on Fox and said, dismiss a defense of American democracy as Democrat, quote, Democrat talking points, you are all in. It's not like you're a little bit pregnant.
I don't know if I agree with that, though, Heather. I mean,
when you have just seen not only an attempt to overturn the election results in several swing states, but also a full-fledged insurrection at the Capitol, I don't see how you can.
But that's not what they voted on. I mean, literally, that's not what ostensibly they did, but that's not what they did. The vote was not, do you think Donald Trump's election was illegitimate? It was, do you want Liz Cheney to be the number three ranking Republican? And they said, we don't want that. So what I'm trying to do is parse how much that vote goes from one to the other. We don't like Liz Cheney. Is that 100%? Absolutely. We believe Donald Trump should be the president of the United States. Maybe this is just my heart here, but I'm hoping that what it could mean is not that these guys all are that stupid or evil or anti-democratic. I mean, they are members of Congress. So maybe it's something else. Maybe it's just that they don't want Liz Cheney to be the number three.
There were a lot of politicians during the civil rights era who made similar, well, I'm not against all Black people voting. I'm just against voting in this specific way. I don't think that there are facts.
Okay, so you think, though, they didn't do this. I'll leave my point here, because you and I don't think we're going to come to an agreement on it. But do you think that if the vote were, did Donald Trump win the election? Should Donald Trump be president by virtue of the last election? Do you think it would have gone the same way?
We got that vote. We got that vote after the insurrection that night. And 2/3 of the Republican caucus challenged results in multiple states. We got that vote on record. So months later, rather than hours after an insurrection, I think the vote might even be greater.
I'm going to lose this argument, aren't I? But I think that the more time lapses, the more clear it is. This is such a ridiculous thing to have to say. The more clear it is that Joe Biden won the election.
I don't think a majority of Republicans would agree with you on that. Oh, I don't.
That are in the Congress.
That are in the Congress.
Austin, correct. Do you want to say anything here? I think it's a referendum.
Well, I think it's a referendum on, can you openly criticize Trump? I actually don't even think the election point is at the crux of it. It's, can you be in leadership of the Republican Party and openly criticize the former president or not, regardless of the issue? And they took a very clear vote that you could not. I think that's unhealthy for the party. And this is really, internal political vote. And the political consequences of that, I think, are the Trump wing of the party can't win by itself. It actually needs the whatever smaller share of the party that doesn't think the election was stolen, this outlandish claim, it needs them in order to win. So the vote is, can you openly criticize the former president? I think if for a healthy party, to Heather's point about like, it's not good for one party to basically have the stance that the election was illegitimate. For a healthy party, you have to be able to openly criticize.
Do you think this could help Democrats in that they can tell any borderline voters in the midterms or the next election, you better stay with us because those guys are still Trumpers and they still believe the big lie?
I don't think the Cheney vote changes that. I think the vote that John and Heather brought up is that was going to be the issue in 2022, regardless of this Cheney issue.
But it's going to put people like Ray LaHood into, it's not, no, it's
Darren,
not Ray LaHood.
Darren LaHood.
parenthood. It's going to put him into a trick bag, because if he says
Darren Hood signed on to the election challenge in Texas, he has picked the battle side.
Well, he was the chair of the Trump campaign in the state of Illinois. Anyway,
signed on to an amicus brief to the Supreme Court of the United States that said because Michigan changed their voting methods, they should be disenfranchised.
Well, but he did say, but
stop giving people the benefit of the doubt. That maybe they thought one thing one time, but maybe in that time that they have come to some sort of epiphany since.
I don't give him any benefit of the doubt. I'm saying that when he was asked about this just yesterday or whenever it was, when he was asked about it, he said, well, I wasn't there. I missed it. And then he was giving some weasel words. He did not stand strongly against Liz Cheney. He is trying to find some middle ground, because he does sense that maybe that signing that amicus brief and some of his earlier stances, that he's trying to walk that back.
I think it's a really important point. Do we emphasize what people say in interviews on any given day, or do we judge elected officials on their actions and policy?
But if it comes down to voting for him or a Democrat, some independents or right-leaning independents will still look and say, I don't like corporate taxes. I don't like this. I don't like that. Yeah, he said all this stuff, but he still aligns with me on this. Even though I promote democracy, I believe Joe Biden's, it should be the president. I'm speaking as one of these voters. But when it still comes down to punching the ticket in an election, most people are still going to go with the policies, I think, that they represent. Mm-hmm. And this is why Democrats did well in 2018. They didn't just run against Trump. They pushed healthcare as the big message. And that's what they tried to run on. That's what they know is their winning issue. And so I don't think it is as easy as saying, well, you were against this, so I'm switching parties for this vote. I don't think a lot of people want to do that.
Well, I think there are a number of people who are really play their politics between the 45-yard lines, and they consider themselves, they are genuinely independent, and they're genuinely concerned. There were a lot of people who were, certainly enough people who were maybe inclined, they're culturally conservative or have are economically conservative, but they just couldn't go all the way to vote for Trump, and they thought that, and that's why Biden was such an excellent choice for the Democrats to run, because Biden was a very comforting, moderate, had a great deal of appeal to moderates because of his manner and his history. So I think there are swing voters out there who really do think, well, I'm here, I'm with him here, I'm not with him here, but I just can't take this crazy cult that they're part of. And I think that those numbers are they're not huge, but they are potentially quite decisive.
Guys, I want to ask you about Helmut Jahn for just a minute here. The famed Chicago architect was riding his bicycle west of town through a stop sign at an intersection and was hit by a vehicle and then hit by another vehicle coming the other way. 81 years old, he passed away, speeding along on his bicycle. No tickets were issued to the people driving the cars. It seems like he just made that fatal mistake. He was always a hard-charging, flamboyant person. I very much enjoyed Chris Jones's sort of obituary the next day, because he reviewed him as an artist, and I think we all revered him, even if we didn't revere the building that's about to go down, the Thompson Center. There's a few things to talk about there. One is, who needs to learn how to better behave on the roads, bicyclists or cars? Not relative to his accident per se, but just in general, we're all sharing that space, and it reignited the debate that I think we have in Chicago about how to handle life on the roads. But then also, does this maybe give the Thompson Center a second life, if that's possible? Austin, why don't you start? What's your thought about all of that?
First of all, design genius, Chicago icon. So many of the iconic imagery of our city that I have just growing up here is due to him, and in the suburbs. And he's just an incredible figure. And I think we should start naming stuff after Helmut Jahn. But
how about the Outer Drive?
Yeah, Helmut Jahn Drive. And I think with regard to the Thompson Center, what really complicates it for me is that taxpayers pay for that building, and it's just incredibly inefficient, and it's a waste of money. It's not even commenting on its like architectural merits. It's not a good space for the public to have to invest in. I don't think his death should change the fact that Illinois finally passed legislation enabling them to sell the Thompson Center. I don't think the city should use its landmark powers to protect that that sale, because frankly, it's wasteful. In terms of bikes and cars, I think Chicago could do a much better job with biking infrastructure. I bike in the city a lot. I've never had a close. I've maybe had two close calls. I've been biking here most days for like 6 years, but generally, we don't know a lot about his exact accident. I think really all we know is the initial report said he blew a stop sign, right, and then was struck by two vehicles, which is just horrifying, but hard to know who was actually at fault, I suppose.
Yeah, there was an interview the next day with, I think it was in the Tribune, maybe the Sun Times, with one of the drivers who said, you know, they were just going about 35 miles an hour, I guess, as they were proceeding through that intersection, didn't see what hit him. Next thing they know, they'd clobbered him, and then the other vehicle hit him too.
Excuse me, I just thought it was interesting that the driver said he didn't see anything until the smash hit the windshield.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, if you're driving along, you're going to see it out of the corner of your eye if you're paying attention to the road. It was just a strange thing for the driver to say. I have no idea what actually happened here. But I will also add to the thing about bicyclists that bicyclists are heedless of stop signs and often stop lights, and they can get away with it most of the time. I was just in our neighborhood the other day. I saw a near collision between a car that didn't stop for a stop sign and a bicyclist that didn't stop for a stop sign. Neither of them did. And the bicyclist was enraged and the driver of the car was abashed. And I thought, well, both you guys ran the stop sign, but bicyclists seem to feel like stop signs are very much advisory. And so I can't imagine a situation in which Helmut Jahn came to the stop sign, stopped, and then eased down into the road and was hit. And just to add, I mean, I agree totally with what Austin said about the Thompson Center. I think it's gorgeous. It's a really beautiful building, but it's very wasteful, very inefficient use of space. And, you know, unfortunately, I agree it probably has to come down and be replaced with something more efficient and more able to generate revenue.
I've biked in the city. I've rolled through stop signs, whether it's biking or driving. I think you drive, you yell at cyclists. You bike, you yell at cars. I think everyone could take a few extra seconds of patience approaching intersections. There's no one there. A cyclist goes through it. That's okay. Doesn't really bother me all that much. Just everyone needs to be wary of which intersections we're talking about, how fast we're going around the surroundings. We could all just use a second more to breathe all the time, whether you're biking or driving.
Well, the physics will dictate who wins any collision.
Right.
So if you're on a bicycle, that's on you. Even if the car is wrong, cars are going to be wrong. Cars run into cars. If you're on a bicycle, you better protect your skin. So you can shake your fist if you want, but I mean, at the end of the day, it's incumbent upon the bicyclist to avoid car-bicycle accidents because they will lose otherwise. You just, there's no way around that. And John, I like you, I guess. I have no problem with people running stop signs. It's impractical for bicyclists, that is, to expect them to stop at stop signs. That's silly. If you look both ways, slow down a little bit, but keep going. It's one of the reasons you're on a bicycle.
Right.
I mean, but it's. I think the infrastructure is really bad in Chicago. You know, I was talking to an attorney who represents a lot of victims in bicycle accidents, and he said that in Chicago, a lot of the infrastructure we have is painted lines on a road. That ain't going to help anybody. You know, he thinks that we should have more barriers, more physical barriers, more concrete partitions to portion off the roads. But there's only so much space, so now you're going to infringe on the place where the cars are, I guess. It's not as complicated right now, though, because there still ain't a lot of cars on the road. Downtown is a lovely place to ride your bicycle these days. Austin, do you agree? I mean, I know that we're about to open the state back up, but it's still a lot easier to ride your bike now than it used to be.
Yeah, and plus the flyover only costs, whatever, $60 million to
64,
do. It's pretty convenient. You also still have to. This whole time, I had the wrong vision of this in my head. I was like, oh, we're going to be able to go around that, you know, post. And you still have to go under it and squeeze in that little area just for a little bit. And that was a little disappointing. But
oh, so have you been on the flyover?
Biking is great right now.
Have you been on the flyover?
Yeah. I went on the first day.
Did you really? Somebody pointed out to me, they said, it's so interesting about the sort of attention we want cyclists to pay to their environment around them. The picture on the front page of the Tribune shows a guy finally using the flyover. He's on his cell phone while he's riding his bicycle. So, so some things will never change. But that thing is beautiful. I have been so anxious for this thing to open up. And if you don't know what it is, describe it, Austin. You're more. I have not been on it yet, but tell me what
so
it is.
You, if you wanted to do an uninterrupted, like I'm in Chicago and I love Chicago so much and I want to be on the lakeshore for 2 hours on a bike ride, you go from whatever, like Rogers Park down to South Shore. You could do that all along the lake, except for this one terribly cramped, dark, dangerous space right by Navy Pier where bikes would have to go, where pedestrians are on this scary raised sidewalk where there's a big steep drop next to where cars were whizzing by. And now it's this beautiful sort of like Mario Kart Rainbow Road style smooth ride up and in, and you can go into the city. It's very nice, but it also took longer than going to the moon.
Hey, Eric, you noted that David Moore, the Southside alderman running for Secretary of State, so this would be his purview, I guess, were he to win, says we should put advertising on our license plates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know how serious the proposal it is, but and I don't know if it's done in other states. I haven't checked on that, but it seems like a bad idea. That I would rather they sell naming rights to Starved Rock or something. You know, if they need money that badly, putting ads on license plates, I don't like it. Just as general point of view, like putting ads on your driver's license or something.
Where would they go? Do you know? Where would it sit? Because you got the numbers and the letters. Where else could you put it?
They would take like Lincoln's Head, and then they put like the Burger King.
No,
I love that.
Okay, now that's sacrilege. But if you can carve out some space, maybe make room for, make it a little while. You can't make it wider or longer. It's already a sort of set place on people's cars.
Well, also, what kind of consumer product would there be that would be universally accepted, that people would say, well, I can't, I don't want, say, Burger King. What if you're a vegan? You know, you don't want a Burger King ad on your Prius.
I even was fine with putting ads on Wrigley Field's Ivy or on the boards, and I love Wrigley Field as it was. But if it helps you grow some revenue and you need it, and the state does, go for it.
That seemed like sacrilege at the time, too, didn't it? And then when they did it, when they put up the extra scoreboard, when they lit the place, when they put advertising out there, it's still Wrigley, don't you think?
And they won a World Series because they had extra revenue.
So maybe we do this. How about this? I will discount your license plate, right? Like if you're a vegan and you don't want Burger King on there, okay. But I will let you even pick the ad that we put on there. We'll discount the cost of your license plate. So now you do put up, say, a Burger King ad on there. And then Burger King also, you know, has to pay to be on there as well. But you sort of subsidize the cost of the plate by asking people if they would allow a certain ad on there.
Who's Can I make my me? Plate Pop-Tarts or something like that? Just spell out something?
Can I just bring up one other thing before we go? And that is, how many businesses have signs in front of them saying we need help and they can't get it? Dunkin' Donuts near me is closed their in-store service because they can't get enough people to work. There's a restaurant in Lake Geneva that folks like to go to. They can't get enough line cooks. So even though summer's coming, they're going to close one day and limit some of their indoor dining because they can't get staff. There's a lot of stories like that with the labor shortage right now. Some businesses are paying people $100 or $300 or $500 if they stay for the first 30 or 90 days just to incentivize people to go back to work. Have you guys noticed this? And what's your comment about that?
To the extent that it is caused by people who feel like they're getting more on unemployment than they would be getting, or they're not making, they wouldn't make as much more going to work would only get them, net them $2 extra an hour or something. That's temporary. And you know, those benefits are going to expire soon. So I don't know if this is just, you know, an artifact of people not being as clear or as being able to predict as well as they should have been able to predict how well, you know, when the pandemic was going to end, when the businesses were going to reopen. So I'm not long-term worried about it. Obviously it's a short-term problem, but I think just all of a sudden cutting people off of their unemployment benefits would be a mistake.
Well, I also don't think there's any evidence to suggest that it's a direct causal relationship between the extra unemployment and the number of jobs that are offered. You know, I have a lot of friends who worked in restaurants and who worked in retail who don't want to go back, and there's not any amount of money that they will accept to take those jobs again
because of their health concern.
Well, it's not just health concerns, but it's also, hey, you know, I found this job maybe making a little bit less money, but I get to work from home and I don't have to get spit on by customers and I don't have to be abused by gross dudes who grab my butt while I'm serving drinks. I think workers are finding that they have the power to be more choosy and more demanding about mm-hmm. how they work and where they work. And I don't know that sort of ending unemployment is really going to change that, because, you know, we talked about it a lot, about how sort of searing this whole pandemic has been for everybody. And I think there are going to be a lot of people who say, you know what, I don't want to go back working for minimum wage plus tips in an environment where I felt unsafe, because I figured out how to survive beyond that. And it's just not worth it anymore. And it will be interesting to see whether it prompts a larger reckoning among American businesses about the conditions that workers have been forced to endure for decades.
That's an interesting point. I think the reckoning, though, for a lot of people right now, John, and I think you and I have heard this on our radio station, is people just think it's because the unemployment benefits have been too generous of late.
Yes, but the $2.13 minimum wage that they make plus tips is insane. And I think it's about time that changed. And hopefully, I agree with Heather. I think it's more life circumstances.
Yeah, I got to say, the only evidence that I would have to the contrary would be completely anecdotal. And so, you know, to the extent that Heather's right, that people have found other gigs, I don't know. I mean, your unemployment rate is 6%. I don't know what it is in Illinois, but you have a situation where, you know, to get unemployment benefits, you've got to demonstrate ostensibly that you're looking for work and that you're not being offered jobs. And given that there are jobs out there, I don't know that how you can sustain a 6% unemployment rate if you have so many jobs that are still wanting. So
yeah, part of that, though, and one thing we haven't mentioned yet, and it's a huge problem with labor supply shortage, is the fact that there isn't consistent scheduling for in-person schooling. And we did research consistent with research that was published in an economic journal called Gender and Society with data in Illinois, and estimated around 28,000 Illinois moms are still out of the labor force purely because of schooling concerns. That's a huge sector of the population. And it's going to take a lot of time to catch up economically for a lot of those women who were forced out of the workforce due to the pandemic and have not returned yet.
Schooling concerns. What does that mean? That they can't go to work because their child is learning from home?
Yes, exactly. Or doesn't have, you know, isn't in 5 days a week scheduling, you know, on off days, things of that nature. That has a huge effect on the labor supply. And women have been hurt the most. Women and people of color have been hurt the most by those effects.
Yeah, I bring that up every now and then, Austin, when we talk about it on the radio. And yet I'm telling you, maybe it's anecdotal too, Eric, but you could light up the phone lines of any radio show in town right now with people who will say, my brother-in-law is taking unemployment and the $300, and he's making more than he was in his job. So why would he go back to work? And he says he won't.
And I think that's part of the reckoning that American business has to come to grips with, because if they've been getting away with people paying not people a living wage, we should not punish the workers for saying, hey, I'd like a living wage.
Oh, sure, they have leverage, but that's American. Sure, they have the leverage, but it's being subsidized by the government right now. For instance, they were living before they got the supplement too. Why do we have to subsidize their life now?
So the states that have seen sort of the largest worker shortage are not ones that have cut off or never extended the extra unemployment. So there's no data correlation between the two. The other is that I think that we all as Americans really enjoy judging other Americans for making choices that we either aren't forced to make and or think that we would make differently. We like to think that we are strong Americans who would decline to suckle from the teat of government beneficence when we all take the mortgage deduction on our taxes.
Amen.
John was jumping up and down while you were talking.
I've got him on my payroll. You guys don't know that.
I think that wraps it up this week, guys. I appreciate John Hansen, you jumping in with us again. You know, we had been closing with any recommendations. Do you guys want to just give us a fast whip around? Austin, anything you've been enjoying in the last week you'd like to share with the whole class?
This is so lame. I had cooler recommendations last 2 weeks, but in Miami, I read the autobiography of Ben Franklin. I've been annoying everyone I know with these Ben Franklin stories. It's the bet, like, probably the best autobiography I've ever read, and was a big part of forming like what the American identity was at that time. Still very readable. You can read it in like 2 days. Great stories. He almost became a professional swim teacher in England. We would not have had the American Revolution. I highly recommend the autobiography of Ben Franklin.
Wow. That's not an audiobook. He didn't voice it, by the way, did he?
I'm reading Karen Tumulty's biography of Nancy Reagan, and it is well interesting and fascinating. And I did not know that Nancy Reagan's mother was a ghost payroller for former Chicago Mayor Ed Kelly back in the Prohibition era, and that Nancy Reagan, her dad was super clouded and connected to all sorts of Chicago muckety mucks back in the day, which just goes to show that Chicago is, in fact, the best political town in the nation.
Well, no argument there. John, you got any recommendations you like?
Yeah, well, I've read two bad books in a row, so I'm going to buy the Ben Franklin one. But I love on Netflix a show called Dairy Girls. It's about five Irish high schoolers living in Northern Ireland, and it's really funny. It's great, and I don't think a lot of people have seen it. Dairy, D-E-R-R-Y.
How about you, Mr. Zorn?
Well, I was listening. I've been listening to the audio version of something called Behind the Desk, the story of Late Night. And it's a CNN podcast, and it just basically tells the story of late night talk shows. And it's just a fascinating look back at the entire history of them. And I think it's also a video. I think there's a whole video component to it, but I have yet to buy into this television thing. I think it's just a fad. So, but podcasting is here to stay. And so this is, like I say, Behind the Desk. And it's a fun listen. Well reported.
We are watching on HBO Mayor of Easttown. I don't know if you guys have caught up with that.
Did you see the parody on Saturday Night Live?
No.
Oh, you must catch up with that because we're watching that as well.
And Kate Winslet's a detective and life is hard for her. And the funny thing is they don't drop the whole thing, right? So you have to wait each week to watch. It's like old time TV, speaking of which, you got to wait until the next episode. So far we have been enjoying it. And the book that I've been reading, a friend of mine, you know, that guy that does Thomas Jefferson, Clay Jenkinson, he has been for about a year trying to get me to read American Carnage by Tim Alberta on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of Trump. And nobody comes off unscathed in the first 70 pages of the book. He said, if you read one book about what happened in the last 2 years, read this one book, American Carnage. And I said, I don't want to read a book called American Carnage. But it turns out it's pretty breezy. It's very contemporary, of course, and so I'm enjoying it so far. I enjoyed you guys. Thanks for joining us today. Austin Berg, Heather Sharone, Eric Zorn, John Hansen. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Olive Garris. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Thank you, campers.
See you guys.
Thank you all.
Hey, John, thanks. Thanks.
Good to see your face, Hansen.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.